Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 2nd, 2002. Today's session is entitled Basic Geological Concepts and Thinking Geologically. This is hosted by Don Coberly, and this is tape number COD 2002-02. Let's listen in.
Start the presentation. This is the second in a series called Geology for Beginners. This session is called The Laws of Geology. For those of you that I didn't get to meet yet or were in the session yesterday, my name is Don Coberly. I'm here for a week on volunteer teaching staff, teaching these three sessions on beginning geology, and then on Friday night, Friday supper time, doing a session on the mine investigation, because that's how I heard about Holden in the first place, was through the mine investigation. I work for the consulting firm that works for Alumet, which is the successor company to Howe Sound that did the mining here. Since Alumet runs mines and doesn't do cleanups, they came to a private consulting firm that I happen to work for back in 1996, and I got sent up here for the first time in 1997, spent 10 weeks in the village between 6 weeks in the spring and 4 weeks in the fall, and having been here for that period of time, it seemed like a pretty nice place. So I've been back probably a dozen or 15 times since then, between doing work for the mine investigation and being on volunteer teaching staff and being here as a guest. So I'm always glad to be back at Holden, and I was glad when Barbara Rossing asked me to come and be on volunteer teaching staff for a week. So Friday will be a presentation, a PowerPoint presentation on the mine investigation to this point. And then Saturday morning will be a hike over on the other side of the creek to look at some of the things related to the mine. This is the second session in three on geology for beginners. Yesterday we talked about rocks. Today we're going to talk about the laws of geology and the principles of geology. And then tomorrow morning we're going to go and take a hike. Whoever wants to, we're going to go take a hike and look at some geology. I don't do this. I do consulting when I work, which means either sitting in my office writing things or being out in the tailings pile sampling wells. So I'm
not in your own environment.
Exactly.
Spitballs.
It's both. I'm both excited and terrified.
That makes me feel better.
It's terrifying to be here. The objective that I had in doing this series is to give you some basic concepts so that then you could go and do geology wherever it is that you happen to live or places that you visit. What separates geology from other sciences is you don't do geology experiments, you go and look at it. You don't calculate geology problems, you go out in the field and you observe. My assumptions are that you have some interest in geology, which is why you're here, and that there's some possibility that in the future you will do some more of it. And the third thing is that you will do that away from Holden, since you're only going to be here for a week or 2 weeks. I don't see any staff, I do see one staff person here. But even in that case, you're gonna be here another year and then go someplace else and live there the rest of your life and do geology there. So if I would talk a lot about the geology of the Holden Valley, that would give you a great benefit as long as you stayed in the Holden Valley, but then when you went back to where you came from, it might not be as useful. So I've talked yesterday in very general terms about the rocks. Today I'm going to talk in very general terms about the laws and principles of geology. When I do things, whatever they are, I try to be able to distill them down to three sentences, and if I can't do that, then I think I'm being too complicated. So here's my take on geology. At its essence, geology is an observational science. That means it is based on observations of rocks, landforms, and the relationship of rock units to one another. Once observations have been made, it is then possible to make interpretations or advance hypotheses about the geologic makeup and history of an area. That's the way I think about geology. You observe, you interpret, maybe you make hypotheses, you test those hypotheses by observing more. I used the example yesterday that if we did a bunch of hiking along this side of the creek and found a bunch of flat-lying rock units, my first question would be, well, do we find them on the other side of the creek? And we'd go over and we'd hike on the other side of the creek and we'd either find them or we wouldn't. And if we did, then we'd say all the rocks around here are flat-lying as far as we can tell. Or if we did, we'd say, why is that? Is it a different rock type over there? Is it the same rock type and they're offset that would make us think that there might be a fault under the creek or something like that? So that's the process that you do in doing geology. As my sort of framework or way to get into today's session, here's our task. We're sent to figure out geology of an unknown area. Say we're from South Carolina. We've never been here before.
Do we have people here from South Carolina?
Yeah, you're picking on them.
Okay. It doesn't look like this here.
Exactly. So, or if you're from someplace else, or if we're all going to someplace that we've never been before and we want to do the geology there, the first thing we would do would be get a base map. And the U.S. Geological Survey topographic maps are the perfect base maps to work off of. The second thing we would do, because then we can locate ourselves in the world so we know where we're hiking. Second thing we'd do would be we'd hike around and look at the rocks. And we put the rock outcrops on the map, where we would find an outcropping of rock, some bare rock that we thought was in place, that it hadn't fallen down the hill. We'd put a little dot on our map and we'd say, speckly rock. If we had a lot more geology, we would say quartz monzonite, whatever the rock type is, and then we'd hike a little further and we'd find another outcrop, and if it was the same, we'd put a point on our map, and if it was different, we'd write that down. The next thing we'd do would be figure out the relationships in space of those rock units. If everywhere we hike, we found all the same rock type, it'd be an easy job. We'd put one unit on our map and go home. If we find rocks in a certain place and then we go to another place and the rocks are different, we go to the third place and the rocks are a little bit different, we go to the fourth place and they're the same as they were at the first place, write all that down on our map and then come back at the end of the day, sit around the table, scratch our heads and go, what in the world is going on here? This is where the laws of geology come in. We use the basic principles of geology that we'll talk about today to help us sort out the relationships of the rock in space. And then we finish our map, and then based on the map, we describe the geologic history of the area. And this part in here is sort of the iterative process of, we use our laws of geology, we start to think we have an idea about what's going on, we start to develop a geologic history, the pieces fit or they don't fit. If they don't fit, we've got to come up with a new, better idea. We do this a bunch of times and we come up with a geologic map. And then you send it to the U.S. Geological Survey. Actually, they have people who come out and do this, and then they publish this map. And this is a USGS topo base map with the various rock units signified by different colors, and then the contacts between the different units highlighted in different ways. If it's just one unit on top of another, there's a certain line that they use. If it's a fault, those are traced on here. And so now, when the rest of us come back here to Holden Village, we can take this map and go hiking and say, all right, we're gonna go hiking up the creek and we're gonna go up to Holden Lake. Here are the geologic units we should anticipate to find. And then you go up there and you hike around and you say, wait a minute, these aren't the right rocks. And so you write the USGS and say there are some problems with the map. And that's the way geology gets done. This is a better map than the one that Holden did in 18 whatever it was, because it's got more data on it. And people have come in and reinterpreted it and will continue to do so.
It's a Holden map.
This is a geologic map of the Holden Quadrant.
And where's Railroad Creek on that?
Well, Railroad Creek is right up here at the top. This yellowish stuff is the more recent material, so with the valley being filled with that recent material. And I'll throw this out, or set this down, and we can look at it together later, because it's impossible for anybody to see except me. So, but there then is a description of all these different colors that go to the rock units on the map and describe the the geologic name of the rock type that you find there and describe it. So.
How often are those updated, do you think?
When somebody gets funding to come out and do more field work.
So that's not necessarily like every 20 years or every...
No, not at all. There are still quads in the country that have never been mapped, and there are quads that have been mapped repeatedly. And these are done to a certain scale. I wouldn't think that someone has gone and hiked every 50 yards of this entire quadrangle and put a point on the map and said, yeah, we're still in this unit. I mean, you make certain assumptions so that if for some reason somebody said, we've got to go up to Holden Lake and map the heck out of it, that's what had happened.
If you did send in a correction like you referred to earlier, would they take it just on your say-so?
That would depend on if I had published other papers about that area. I mean, you get to, if I just wrote them and said, hey, I was hiking around Holden Valley and saw this and I think your map's wrong, they probably wouldn't do anything about it. If I had been working in this area and had known some people at the Geological Survey, I mean, to me it's like anything else. If you get known for doing something, they have some faith in what you say. Or they might send somebody else up to look at it, or they may say, well, all right, in 12 years when we revise that map again, your correction will be in it. So it's not, I guess I was talking sort of conceptually rather than specifically that they may or may not do that. How do the laws help us if we're not building a new geologic map? What I talked about yesterday and sort of my objective here is to get you down the road with some hints and helpful shortcuts that you can use so that when you go to do geology, wherever that is, that you have a little head start on the game, or you can read a book and be thinking ahead, or can, if you're working with friends, you can help explain it to them. There is a series of books called The Roadside Geology of, and then fill in the state here, that I find to be a very good middle ground between being too simple and being too complicated. The other value in the Roadside Geology series is that they're based on the roadways that you take from point A to point B, so that if you want to take Highway 101 down the California coast from Arcata to San Francisco, you get the Roadside Geology in Northern California and you look under Highway 101, and sure enough, here's the geologic history, and it says at mile point 65 out of Arcata, this is what you're going to see. And you can pull over and you can read what a reasonably competent geologist has written about it and say, all right, here it is. It's a movable geology class without the cost of tuition. So it's just what it, so I think these are good books, and what following the laws of geology or thinking about them, being exposed to them for the first time, will help you understand sort of these concepts more quickly. Anytime that you want to ask a question, feel free. If you're bashful about doing that in class, see me anytime between now and Saturday when I leave. I will be glad to tell you what I know about these things. First law, the first principle Before we get to the laws, there is one overriding principle of geology, and it's called the principle of uniformitarianism. And that's explained on the first handout that you have. Before that,
hey, we're familiar with that in South Carolina.
Do you have any more handouts?
I sure do.
I need to jam something.
I got you. I happen to think that geology is pretty important, but I've been to a place where opinions differ on that. This is in suburban Joplin, Missouri, where I did a bunch of work around the mine site. And so, and there, that's not a joke to the First Baptist Church. This first slide describes, explains, highlights the principle of uniformitarianism, which says that the present is the key to the past. It means that we can look at geologic happenings right now and be confident that they are the same things that have gone on in the past. We can look at glaciers right now and the way that they operate and believe that 10,000 years ago when the main glacier came down here and did what it did, it is doing exact or reasonably the same thing that glaciers are doing today up in Alaska. And we can extrapolate that further to the glaciations that happened 250 million years ago and say glaciers operated the same then as they do now. And when we see the Hawaiian volcanoes exploding, we can say, all right, where we find other volcanoes of that type, the explosions were reasonably, the eruptions were reasonably the same as we see today. Or volcanoes of the type that we see at Mount St. Helens, we can make guesses about the deposits that they would leave and the way that they erupted because we can see modern, or we can see current examples of that. That it didn't used to be that rain fell up or rivers flowed uphill or anything like that. That the geology that we can see in the current day, things that have happened in the past. So that's an overriding principle of geology. I happen to think that there was a period of the Earth very early in the Earth's history where that probably didn't hold. That as the Earth was solidifying and asteroids were blasting into it, things may have been a little bit different, but this principle covers at least, I don't know, 2.5 or 3 billion years, so that's good enough, I think. That covers the majority of it. So, the first law of geology is the law of original horizontality. We talked yesterday about the primary or the most common rock type being sedimentary rock, a rock that is formed of sediment grains that have been moved by air, water, or ice and then deposited and then turned into rock. And the law of original horizontality states that those layers, those rock layers, were laid down originally horizontally. It's hard for water to lay things down on an angle. Just gravity suggests otherwise, right? So the implication then is if we find rocks that are not horizontal, that we have to imagine something that got them into that position, that they weren't necessarily laid down that way. Now we can think of exceptions to that rule. On the flanks of Mount St. Helens are ash flow deposits that are at 45 degree angles or something like that, but those are, in the grand scheme of things, relatively minor. They're exceptionally minor for sedimentary rocks, which, again, is the vast majority of rocks that we will find are at that. So it's a really simple rule. Things got laid down flat. That's way simpler to me than the law of original horizontality, but you can't get a master's thesis on the rocks get laid down flat. The second law is the law of superposition, which says that if we have our horizontal beds, the
one at the bottom was the one that got laid down first.
Surprising started in black.
What's it?
So that if one is oldest, one got laid down, two got laid down on top of it, two got laid down on top of it. We could turn this thing upside down and try to think of a way to shove layers one under the other, but it doesn't work very well in geology. So that's the law of superposition. Now, because geology, things get a little bit squirrely in geology sometimes, and mountains get built, and continents collide and things like that, there is the chance that these rocks could get tipped up to the point where there's a portion of them that has been bent more than 90 degrees. So here's 1, 2, and 3 in their original orientation. In fact, now we have the youngest rock on top of the oldest rock. You say, well, that probably can't happen very often. Well, the closest place to hear that happens is about half a mile away up on Honeymoon Heights. The ore deposit that the Holden mine is based off of is dug out of rocks that have been overturned. So it's important to figure out which way is up in the rock world anyway. So I have a number of handouts, but before we go to which way is up, let's take a quick second and do a little non-geology exercise to help us understand geology. What you have on that color handout is a plate sitting on a table, and I burned a candle on the plate of a certain color and then let it die out, and then put another candle on top of it and burned the second candle on top of the first candle and let it run all over the place, and then I burned a third candle and let it run on top of the first two and then burned a fourth one. And so my thinking is that we should be able to figure out by looking at it, because we know this whole thing hasn't been turned upside down, that we should be able to figure out the order that the candles got burned in. And then this to me is completely analogous to going out and mapping basalt flows, because they run all over the place and lay over one the top of one another. If we were looking at the salt flows, we would have the added ability to age data, but in this case we're just looking at the field relationships one over the next, and we should be able to figure out which came first.
You want us to guess?
Or you already got it figured out?
I think I got it. Blue. Blue's on the bottom, and then
white.
Red.
White.
Black. No. Yeah, white, red, black.
Blue.
White, red, black. Yeah. Blue, red, white, black.
Okay. Let's look at the things that we can see straight away. Red has to be on top of white.
Yeah.
We've got red flowing on top of white right here, right?
Yep.
What else?
On top of blue.
Sorry?
Everything's on top of blue.
Are you sure?
I can see red on blue. I can see black on blue.
I can see blue on black right here.
Yeah.
So I've got blue on top of black.
You were burning a candle at both ends. That's what you're
doing. That's right. It's a trick. No, it isn't a trick at all. I've got blue on top of black here. I've got red on top of white here. Do I have white on top of anything? Maybe on top of blue right here.
Black.
Where is it underneath black?
something on the black map.
White's on top of
it. Yes, it is. And down here we have white on top of
black.
So, is anything on top of red?
Black.
Where?
Right in the center.
Right in the center.
Right in the center?
Yeah, above that.
This little dot looks like it's on top of red.
Didn't some of the hot stuff from the time before melt some of the ones that were underneath, and that's why they're mixed up?
Isn't this why you make real observations rather than the pictures? Pictures are all good guesses to what reality.
Yeah, next time I'll bring this. I think I threw it out. I don't know whether that black in the middle is simply the residue that's sort of left down in the, what would be the pit of our volcano.
But wouldn't the hot melt blocks melt some of the ones when it first?
It might do that. There's that possibility. I don't know if it would, if it's hot enough that it would get that, it would sort of remobilize it, and then you would see some mixture of the two. I think black's on the bottom. I see white on top of black, I see red on top of black, and I see blue on top of black.
So maybe I'm not visualizing three dimensions as well, you know, from this two-dimensional photograph. But
that's true.
I'm sort of, my eyes are saying that this thing is kind of a little mountain with a high point in the middle where that black is.
That it was the last candle burned because that's what it was.
There you go. Then how do you get
white on top of it?
Right. Most geology is magic in the end.
Black wax is more dense than white. Yeah. Physical density problem.
I kind of like black on the bottom. I'm not sure. I haven't come up with a good explanation for it yet. Black, white, red, and blue.
How do you get yellow and red?
What
about the black
on
top of the blue?
There's some red on top of the blue.
Up here, I think this is red that has come down two different times, and this. I think this red is sort of butted up against the black both here and here. So it looks like the black has flowed out over the top of the red.
I'm
going to
do this in gold.
Okay. Good. The other thing about geology is it's not very clear cut usually. We've proved it.
What's the answer?
That's on the quiz. I can't tell you. All right, which way is up? Was that a crack? Are you going to have to stay after?
Is that going to be on a test?
All right, so there are different ways that we can use to decide which way is up. One of the ways that we can do this is if we can follow a bed. We know these are in their original position, and if we can continue to follow that bed, at some point we follow it and it gets overturned and we say, all right, we know where it is in its original position. Therefore, we can assume that even though we've gone from younger to older or older to younger, in space, we know that these are overturned. Another chance that we have to look at is if there are scouring or channel marks in a unit, we can assume that it's right way up. The other way to look at this is if we turn this over, we have these sort of little humps out in space, and gravity sort of suggests that that isn't going to happen. I have an example of that from the real world. This is a coral reef down in Florida that had some looks like stream channel cut through it, and the stream channel is then filled in with sediment. The other, so our guess can either be that this is in place the way it is, or we can say the whole bloody mess is turned upside down, and now we have sort of this anthill with material filled in all around it, and this is just a hard thing to have happen in the natural world. If there were, when you get mountains, what happens is they tend to get eroded away. So this thing would be flattened out unless this were somehow something much bigger, and then trying to put stuff on the side of it and getting it to stick would be a problem. If there were layers laid down, they would be thinner here and then become thicker as it would go away. So the guess is that this is the more appropriate way. The sky helps, okay.
It's not a class of astronomy.
Let me ask you a question. Are there, let's say that you have, I'm not even sure what terms to use, but two different compositions of rock. Is it ever the case that two compositions of rock merge to produce a new rock, a third kind of rock?
Sure.
So how can you tell that that third rock is in fact merging together of the initial two? How can you separate the first rock from the second rock, all that stuff?
You can't, because by the time that those two rocks have merged into the third is essentially a new thing. That would happen in a magmatic where they had melted together. And if you had a situation where you knew that there was a rock, a specific rock type that was cooled on one side and then partially melted, and the same thing on the other side, then you could make some guesses as to what that composite chemical composition would be, and anticipate that that's what you would find. So if you know, most rocks are probably recycled anyway, and it's hard to tell after a certain point what the original source rock was, because it's been so badly either metamorphosed and changed or has been re-assimilated into a new magma, and you lose the characteristic of the original rock.
So a lot of geologic history is concealed.
A lot of geologic history is gone. We're reading the fourth version of the paper, and what those first three versions were, we have no idea.
Yeah.
There are a number of different clues that we can use to decide which way is up. If their conglomerate is formed at the base, if we had some sedimentary rocks that had been laid down and then uplifted, and then a stream channel started to flow on top of them, it would pick up pieces of the original unit and move them somewhere downstream, and then you would find them in the conglomerate. Again, turn this upside down and try to make some sense of it. We have this material that's a sandy stone with conglomerate at the top of it, and now we've laid stuff down flat on top of it. That doesn't make sense physically. And how you can get pieces of the newer material into the older stuff in this situation just doesn't work very well. There are a number of these ways we can continue to go through them. The bottom line is, there are lots of different ways that we have to figure out which way is up and is our package in the proper orientation, so that we can then say old is at the bottom, young is at the top. That's the law of superposition and ways to figure out which way is up. The next one is the law of inclusions. And that relates to the next slide that I have here, and I have kind of, this is a page out of the field book that I wrote in 1980 as a sixth-year senior at geology field camp. Well, then, the fact that it took me 10 and a half years to get a master's will make you feel great.
Geological time scale takes
And also trying to figure out the mathematical series of 6 for a bachelor's, 10 and a half for a master's, what a doctorate would be. I think I could just finish my doctoral studies and go right on to Social Security. But only if I start soon. So. All right, what is this? First off, an exploration pit at the base of Saddle. Lots of instructive features. That was written by somebody who knew his professor was going to read the book later. Lots of instructive features. What does that mean? And it also shows that I couldn't draw very well in those days, because if anybody can figure this out, they're doing better than I can.
Yeah, why is it in a box?
Because it was in a pit. There was a pit that was dug into the side of the hill here. Oh, and I can't draw a pit, so I drew a box. And did anybody hear the plane coming by?
Yes. Yeah.
Did anybody not hear that? This story that I'm going to tell is about when we were mapping in a saddle between two different rock bodies, one of this that we called KQM and the other that we called KG.
What do they mean?
KGM
and KG.
KGK, the capital letter K, is the age designation of the rock for Cretaceous rock. QM is a quartz monzonite, which is a kind of igneous rock, and G is for granite, which is another kind of igneous rock. There are these two rock units of reasonably the same stuff mapped right next to each other. And we had mapped the contact between two of them, and the question that we couldn't answer was, which is older and which is younger? And so finally we found this pit that had been dug on the side of the hill by a previous year's geology class to help us out. But this plane coming by today reminded me of when we were up mapping in this saddle between these two things. You ever have that, you're standing there, and you ever have the feeling that something really big is happening behind you, and you turn around? Well, up in this saddle, as we were mapping, I had one of those feelings. The field location that we were at was just up the valley from Edwards Air Force Base in California, so all the hotshot pilots would go flying around the valley. Well, I turned around, and there was a plane there that was up on its wing, going that way at about 400 miles an hour, about 30 feet off the ground. And the pilot's name was either Peters or Peterson, because I could read it on his helmet. He was that close. And so, of course, I went, and the first 2 seconds were really quiet as he was going by. And then the sound wave hit me. And when we got together at the end, we had groups spread out all along the saddle doing mapping of the various areas, and of course that was the topic at lunchtime, was, did you see that? Because this, and we were the last group in the saddle, and I got to see him, and then he went down and down the valley and away at about 400 miles an hour. So when I heard this plane go by a little while ago, I thought, if I'd had a rock in my hand, I could hit it. So, anyway, back to geology. We have a dike of KG which cuts through the main body of KQM. A chill zone is present in the dike. Faster cooling leads to fine grain. That's a tip from yesterday, right? We talked about rates of cooling for magmatic rocks. The faster the cooling, the finer the grain the material was. A bake zone occurs in the surrounding wall rock. The recrystallization seems to make the parent rock darker. The xenolith of KQM is present. So, to describe this a little better, here we have a rock unit that we call KQM. That's not really, doesn't really matter much
We also had a rock unit called KG. What we found in the KQM was that as we got closer to this KG unit, it became darker, and it indicated that maybe this KQM had been recrystallized a little bit. We saw that in the KG, there were finer crystals close to the border. And then the crystals were larger in the middle of the unit. And finally, there was a xenolith, which is a piece that sort of doesn't belong, of the KQM within the KG. Conclusion is that the KG came in later. Reasons for that are, well, what are the hypotheses? What are the different ways this could happen? We had KQM laid down. We had some KG laid down on top of it, and then more KQM. If that had happened, we wouldn't have seen these baked zones on the edges of the KQM. What this indicates is that there was something hot that was sort of injected into this material and remobilized, started to recrystallize it a little bit and make a new rock out of it. And also, somewhere along the line, this stuff was hot enough and injected fast enough that it just ripped a piece of the KQM out, and now you see it in this KG. So the conclusion is that this KQM is older, and the KG was younger and was injected. As it got injected in, cold surfaces on both sides, faster cooling at the edges than in the middle. So.
Were you looking at like a rock surface, large, like almost like a cliff face?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, it was a pit, so it was maybe, my box here is probably 10 feet across and 10 or 12 feet deep, and we could see it in two walls of the pit, and it had been fractured by later stuff, but this is what we could see. So the law of inclusions says that if this stuff is included in this, this is the older and this is the younger. It's hard to get younger stuff in inclusions in the older stuff. That's the law of inclusions. Any questions? Next is the law of cross-cutting relationships. And I'm going to try a new experiment here. I've never tried this before, so disaster is lurking. Here's the idea. I'm going to do a couple of different things on this piece of paper. I'm going to draw a line. And then I'm going to put a piece of tape on the line. Or I'm going to put a piece of tape on the paper. And then I'm going to cut the piece of paper. This is kind of like a magic trick. Different because you don't get a lot of geology out of the magic tricks. All right. And then I'm going to take a piece of paper back on. Okay. Is that everybody like that? Thank you. Okay, now we go into the imaginary part of this. I take this up and I roll it up and we put it in the Holden
village safe. And we come back 10 years from now, and we're all wiser and more mature and still all good looking. And we bring this thing back out, and I go, looks to me like I drew the line first, and then put the tape on it, and then cut it, and then taped it again. And everybody goes, that's amazing. I say, no, it's just like a joke. The point here is, the law of cross-cutting relationships says that younger events cut older events. What was the first event?
The line.
What was the second event?
Masking tape.
So if it's kind of probably hard for you in the back to see, but the masking tape breaks the line. Same thing. What's the third event? Cut the paper. So that the cutting breaks both the black line and the masking tape. Law of cross-cutting relationships.
Made simple.
Take this to the world of geology and go into the handouts. This next series that says exercise 6 relative dating, there's a joke in there about relative dating somewhere, but I'm not going to say
that. Why should I highlight it?
That's the main reason I didn't want to say anything about it.
Actually, Julia and I were wondering, we got a great marriage, but if we ever get divorced, will we still be first cousins?
It's time for more magic, Don.
This is a whole, I've just Xeroxed an exercise out of an old geology workbook for you to take home with you and mess around with if you wanted to, that talks about the things that we've learned up to this point. Law of original horizontality, law of superposition, and the law of cross-cutting relationships. And we can think about, and this to me is one of the cool things about geology, I think if you like doing puzzles, you like geology, and if you don't really like doing puzzles, you should like be in another lecture. Because doing geology is, 2 years ago when I taught this title, I think this section was titled Detective Work Without the Blood, because that's kind of what I think of geology as being. So we find a condition out in the field and we observe it and then we try to figure out what it means. So there are a series of increasingly complicated block diagrams here that describe various geologic conditions that we might see and how they might be represented once we see them out in the field. So that in this simplest diagram, we have three layers that were laid down horizontally, oldest to youngest, and then offset by a fault, and then a layer that gets put in on, that fills in on top of it. Law of original horizontality says they were laid down horizontal, they still appear to be in that same position. Law of superposition says we should find the oldest unit on the bottom, the youngest unit on the top. Law of cross-cutting relationships says that things that get cut are older, the thing that cuts is younger. The fault cuts units 1, 2, and 3, but doesn't cut unit 4, so that if we were doing just a listing of youngest to oldest, or first event to last event, we would write those down. Unit 1 laid down, unit 2 laid down, unit 3 laid down, fault offsets units, unit 4 laid down. Then if we could go back through other means of radiometric age dating or by using fossils, now we can assign a specific age to each of these units or to one of these units or to some of these units. And make a better guess as to exactly when these things happen. The first thing we want to do is get things in the right order, and then we can put an age to it. So the next few pages go through increasingly more complicated examples of ways that we find things in the world. This next set of block diagrams shows a series of units that get laid down horizontally. They get tipped up by some mountain building episode or by some compression that forces them up. The mountain surface gets planed off to be flat again, and then more deposition occurs on top. And what this unit 8 shows is that some of the material that we find in the lower units gets picked up and included as conglomerate pebbles or cobbles in the base of that unit number 8. So we could go back to our which way is up handout and say we find these cobbles at the base. That helps convince us that in fact the whole package is still turned or is still in its original right way up rather than being overturned. This series of block diagrams we'll see again in just a minute. There are two other block diagrams down at the bottom that show the condition where a number of units get laid down and then get folded. If the folding had happened after unit 4 were laid down, unit 4 would be bent as well. So what this shows, we could say, what's our geologic history here? Unit 1, 2, and 3 get laid down horizontally, law of original horizontality. Then there is some warping event that causes those things to bend. But that happens before or as unit 4 is being laid down. Unit 5 gets laid down on top of the flat. Here's another situation where, in fact, this warping takes place and then there is some period of uplift so that the tops can get all eroded away and another unit gets laid down on top that includes some pebbles or cobbles of the underlying units.
Does things get confusing if the erosion is, if there's enough time for a lot of erosion in between layers, that if, you know, it's water erosion or something where it's really cutting into layers and then, so it's not being laid down flat where you can see clearly. If there's a lot of erosion, that wouldn't it just confuse things and you don't quite know what happened first or second if it's all cut up and
well, there's the
earthquake dumps something.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. Doing geology where I did at my bachelor's was at Humboldt State in Northern California, which is an impossible place to do geology because the geology is horribly complicated. And because it's so wet there, you can't see anything. The soil layers are 10 or 15 or 20 feet deep. So you never get to see rock exposures like we can see all around us here. It's horrid. And so it's not so much the erosion, it's the stuff that gets put down in after the erosion. I mean, the Grand Canyon is eroded really deeply. And it's as good a place to do geology as there is because you can see it. Yeah. It's not the erosion.
I was thinking of with not only erosion, but then if there was an earthquake, things got dumped in and then, you know, pressure, but then there was some kind of uplifting thing. I would think that all of those actions could really just
absolutely scramble. Yes, you're absolutely right. That's why my geologic map that I did in 1980 has a location that we call Horror Hillside, because we just couldn't tell what was going on. We had mapped there for an extended period of time and gone back, and four of us, we were all fairly smart, sat around trying to figure out what we could figure out. In the end, we just couldn't. So, yeah, there are times And I assume that we wouldn't have to travel very far here in the valley before some of the geology gets pretty squirrely. So yeah, this, you know, these are the most simplified examples that we could possibly get. Okay. Go ahead.
The idea behind foliage is pretty interesting because rocks don't mold very well. They're not that plastic, right? So when you see fracturing going on, what last two diagrams in that chart?
Oh, absolutely.
And therefore, in order to view what the folding would be like, you have to have a cross section in order to examine that, right? Otherwise, all you see is fractures that cause the rocks to intermingle somehow.
Well, do you see fractures? Yes. Do you also see folded rock? Sure. You can see those. Like, again, we're talking, you know, this isn't happening on a scale that's 30 or 40 feet across. This is happening on a scale of miles across, so that we can map it on a geologic map. We can see these bends and folds. In the smaller scale, you don't see rocks that get folded without them also being fractured. They rocks are a little bit ductile under the conditions that they get folded under, which is if you fold them over a million years, a little bit at a time, you can bend them pretty hard and put cracks in them, but they won't break. So you'll see, you will see fractures, but not so much that, well, and at some point, if that fracture goes far enough, it becomes a fault, and now you do see sort of intermingled rock at one location where the stuff on the upside of the fault has been pushed against different material. So yeah, the next set of handouts that you have, that first stuff that's by Peterson and Rigby, is all just more complicated as it goes through, and there is text that goes along with that that further explains the laws that we've talked about. And then I have added another couple of pages on relative dating. What I like to do generally when I'm trying to learn something is find two different sources and read them both and then figure out which one makes more sense to me. So these two pages on relative dating are the same thing that we've been talking about for the last 10 minutes, just from another source to see if it sounds better to you and if it's more helpful. There are the block diagrams on the side that show some of the same which way it is up techniques that we've already talked about, and then some more block diagrams that show this relative dating technique, and it's the same thing in somebody else's words. And I just included that in case that might be a better way for you to hear it. The next page is a quiz for you to take at home with a picture, a block diagram on one side, and then the description of what happened. This is the page from Press and Siever that says Hutman Uniformitarianism on it. If you want, you can just cover up the text here and try to figure out the geologic history and then see how good you did. Pretty much the last thing I want to talk about starts on that next handout with the series of events and then the little picture down in the corner. And page 33. And we've seen a block diagram reasonably like this before that talks about a series of events that happen. Sediments were deposited horizontally, oldest at the bottom, youngest at the top. They were folded during mountain building. The surface of A is eroded, and then additional new surfaces or additional new deposits are deposited on top of that surface. That separation surface is what geologists call an unconformity. And it's one of the ways that rock units contact other rock units. And it's to start to think geologically about things like this. There, when you find an unconformity, there's just a whole lot of stuff that's implied there. And when you find that unconformity, essentially what's implied is that everything else that's shown on these diagrams has taken place. That if you find a series of folded rocks and a surface and then flat rocks lying on top of them, you should be able to trace back and say, all right, I know what's happening. And it's just this history that we've described in these block diagrams. And this is, in fact, what happened in 1788. And the person who first sorted this out was a guy named James Hutton, who is considered the father of modern geology. And it was at a place called Sicker Point, which is in Scotland. And Hutton was a sort of gentleman farmer who had a little too much time on his hands. So he could go out hiking around, and he went to Sicker Point, and he saw, I think this is a kind of a staged photograph of some guy in his old gear with plaid pants, looks like. Must have just come back from playing golf. On top of the unconformity at Sicker Point, here are a set of vertical rocks lying vertically, an interface, and then more rocks that are lying somewhat horizontally. At that point in 1788, the primary view of geology was that there were two events in geology, creation of the earth and Noah's flood. So geology class was short. You could do it in the morning and be done by coffee break. So.
And understand.
Yeah, I guess. And then Hutton, who was interested in geology, went to Sicker Point and sat and looked at this thing and had one of those eureka moments in science and said, wait a minute. And was the first person, at least the first person in the West. I've only started thinking about it recently, but I think a study of geology through the ages in China would be really interesting. It would have the overprint of the biblical interpretation, and it's probably a story we don't know very well because we've already credited James Hutton as being the father of modern geology. We don't worry about what's going on in the parts of the world. But if I can get somebody to pay for that, maybe that's a their masters. Anyway, Hutton saw this and came back to this set of conclusions and said, all right, these things didn't get laid down vertically. They got laid down horizontally. So we had to have some time of laying rocks down horizontally, and there's a bloody lot of them. And he looked at what was going on at the beach that day and the day before, and it didn't look like rocks were being laid down very rapidly. So he said that must have taken quite a long time. Second thing is they somehow had to get tipped up on end. And I don't know which is up here and which is down, but they're reasonably close to vertical, so it probably wouldn't take much longer to tip them 92 degrees than 88 degrees, but it'd take a long time. Then there's this unconformity. And there's no way to know without age dating how much time is taken up in that unconformity. It could have been 100,000 years, it could have been billions of years. There's just no way to know that. It may have taken longer, there may be more time represented in that knife edge of unconformity than there was in everything else put together. Just without age dating, we can't tell. When we're doing the relative stuff, it's unclear. After the unconformity, we had to lay down a bunch more stuff. I'm assuming that these are oceanic sediments of some kind. They look thin bedded, so they're either lake or ocean sediments. And then they had to get uplifted to where we could see them and tilt them some more. And his point was, this all hasn't happened. Today it didn't happen in Noah's flood, and it didn't happen since 4004 BC, which is what was at that point the formation date. So, to, for a geologist, I guess, this is sort of, it's almost like Wrigley Field to a Pepsi. It's the birthplace of modern geology, at least as I understand it. And it's, to me, one of the revolutions in science. It just happens to have happened in the science that I have studied the most. So there's that picture, and then a color picture of the same location for you to take with you. That shows that spot at Sicker Point. And I just have a couple of last slides that show another angular unconformity. This is in the mountains in Colorado at Glenwood Springs. If you're driving along I-70 there, you can see this. Here are a series of beds. I'm assuming that these are oldest at the bottom, the youngest at the top. That's just a guess because things more often get tipped at 45 degrees than at 135, which is what they'd have to do if they were tipped all the way over. And then some unconformity, and then more recent material on top. So, and you can stop I-70 in Glenwood Springs and shoot that photo just like I did. It's out there. See? I think that's all I have time to talk about today. Tomorrow, 10:45, out on the dock, we'll take a hike down to 10 Mile Falls, which is how far each way?
Mile
each way. We'll talk and do arm-waving geology along the way and put into practice some of the things that we talked about the last 2 days and learn some new stuff. And if there's any questions, come see me. I'm around till Saturday. And it looks like somebody needs to use this room. Or not.